Hey, it's time for Windows Weekly. Paul Theron and Mary Jo Foley are here. We'll take a look at Microsoft's quarterly results. Some pretty good news for Big Green. And Windows 8.1 Update 1 coming soon to a computer near you. It's all next on Windows Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Theron and Mary Jo Foley, episode 347, recorded January 29th, 2014. Welcome to Booty Bay. Windows Weekly is brought to you by ShareFile from Citrix. Try ShareFile today for a 30-day free trial. Go to ShareFile.com, click the microphone, and enter Windows. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code Windows1. It's time for Windows Weekly, the show where we cover all the latest news from Microsoft. And here it is, ladies and gentlemen, drinking and talking at the same time. The ventriloquial stylings of Mr. Paul Theron, Supersite for Windows.
Hello, Leo.
Hello, Paul. WinSupersite.com. Also, Mary Jo Foley from AllAboutMicrosoft.com, wearing her spiffy Lumia headphones, lemon yellow. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
So, we had an earnings call from a Microsoft.
Which now seems like it was a month ago.
It does. It was Friday, right? Was it Friday?
Yeah. Thursday.
Thursday, the day after last Windows Weekly. So, we haven't talked about it
yet. Yeah. Usually they do it during Windows Weekly, but we moved it to now I'm regretting, because it was so much fun. On Thursdays, we would wait and wait. And
I kind of expected them to move the earnings announcement, but
they aren't paying attention, apparently. Yeah. Well, that's because Rob Greenlee left, you know, and that's...
Right.
That's all. Yep. By the way, a tip of the hat to Rob Greenlee, who was for, I think, 8 years, the podcast guy at Microsoft.
A patron saint of podcasting at Microsoft.
Yeah.
Now we're screwed, though, because who's the podcast guy now at Microsoft?
When Rob left, they didn't really say there was somebody taking his place.
They did not.
That's all. Goodbye. And he has taken a new job, where I can't remember where, though, but I'm sure I'll find it. Anyway, very happy for Rob and his...
It is a podcasting company.
Yeah.
I can't think of...
It's called, the name is simple, Podcast One.
Okay.
Actually, I thought that's funny. Yeah, no, and in fact, I interviewed the founder of Podcast One, who's a... longtime radio guy. He wants to bring the same kind of model for radio ad sales to podcasting, which will just be fabulous.
Yeah.
Norm Pattis. He's the guy. You know the guy because you see him courtside at the Lakers games every game.
So he's not hurting for money.
He has so much money, and now he's decided that he's going to take all the money from us.
I'm sometimes seen TV side at a Celtics game.
With his feet up and a bowl of nachos in his lap. Anyways, congratulations, Rob, on the new job. And we will miss you because he's been a great advocate for podcasting at Microsoft. Yep. I really feel he's the reason that Windows Phone has a podcast category and all of that. So, however, that... did not seem to impact the bottom line at Microsoft.
No.
Who wants to take the lead on this one?
Let Paul do the basic numbers.
Heavy lifting.
Jeez.
Yeah, the heavy lifting.
I could do it. You want me to
so
do it?
So Microsoft announced last Thursday that their net income for the most recent quarter, which I believe is their second fiscal quarter, but we might think of it as the fourth calendar quarter of 2013, was $6.56 billion. Revenues were $24.52 billion, which was a record for that quarter. And so, you know, the kind of general point there is that this business that is apparently, you know, circling a drain somewhere is, in fact, going gangbusters.
I got to point out one thing, though.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean this in a negative way. But Apple's profits were doubled Microsoft's for that quarter.
Yeah, Actually, and in that quarter.
If for people like you and me who have been watching this since the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
That is like such a turnaround.
Apple's, if you just look at iPhone.
It's all iPhone.
That business is bigger than all of Microsoft.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
It's particularly true in the quarters where, you know, Apple has an iPhone launch like they did in that fourth quarter.
This was also the holiday buying quarter, and I think that's bigger on a consumer electronics company like Apple than it is at a company like Microsoft.
Yeah, and actually this would be a good way to transition to what Mary Jo had written about this, but we'll probably never stop doing this, you know, comparing Apple and Microsoft. The truth is, I don't think these companies are all that comparable, and it's funny because in many ways, they were never all that comparable. When Apple wasn't doing so well and they sold this minority, PC platform, I mean, it was kind of hard to, you know, compare them to Microsoft.
It was in the kind of it that, well, of course, you're right. It was a hardware company, not an operating systems company, but it was the competing.
But we still compared them. They made that one alternative, one major alternative anyway. And, today, Apple, of course, has seen great success with the consumer devices products. iPod first and iPhone and iPad, but that's something Microsoft has never done particularly good, you know, well at. And that business has been huge for Apple. But the one thing that Microsoft has been very consistent about is its performance on the business side. And I think that's the kind of analysis piece that Mary Jo had written about.
Yeah, that's what you said. He said Microsoft is still, and this is in her All About Microsoft blog, an enterprise company, and that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I saw so many headlines right after earnings came out of people saying this proves they're on their way to becoming a devices and services company. Just look at the numbers. Well, if you actually do look at the numbers, where Microsoft made all their money last quarter was in enterprise software, pretty much. Yeah. So it's they are in the midst of transitioning to being a devices and services company. But if you use their new classification in terms of how they break out their numbers, the far and away biggest part of their quarter came from the part that's called commercial licensing. And what's in that is Windows Enterprise, server products, Office business products, Dynamics, which is ERP and CRM, and Unified Communications. All software, all business products. No Xbox, no Bing, consumer.
Can I ask you a question on that note? You just used the word commercial, which is the word that Microsoft uses to describe the business products. Is that new language? Because
it is.
I spoke to two different people from Microsoft over the past 24 hours, and both of them used the word commercial to describe this part of the business. And I thought that's either I'm, you know, demented and you know, losing it quickly, or I just haven't been paying attention or something, or they have never used this language. This is new language, isn't it?
It's definitely, I don't know exactly when they started calling enterprise commercial, but it's definitely been within the past few quarters, I would say. So they talk about consumer and commercial. They don't talk about enterprise and consumer. But anyway, it's a little bit confusing because sometimes when you hear the word commercial, you're thinking retail, right? But that's not actually what we're talking about here. We're talking about business.
I find it to be an odd term.
It is. When I hear it, I have to kind of think through it before I'm like, wait, which segment are we talking about now? second biggest segment. Okay, so enterprise software totally blew everything else away. Second biggest segment was this part of the company called devices and consumer licensing. So what's in there? All the Windows sales, Windows Phone OS sales, Office consumer for some reason, and IP licensing.
Yeah.
And that was the second biggest group of products in terms of their contribution to both net profits and revenues for the quarter.
IP licensing, that's interesting. Wow.
Yeah, so they call that licensing.
That would be $5 a handset they get from Android, for instance. Yeah.
Right, and you know, a lot of people were trying to do the math based on what they announced during earnings to figure out how much of the part they call Windows Phone is actually patent licensing revenue versus the OS revenue. And it's a little tricky to break that out. They make it hard to break that out. The way they've got their earnings reporting segments organized now, I've seen some Wall Street analysts say it's much clearer and more transparent. I actually think it's much cloudier and less transparent. And Paul just left.
Wait, where did he go? Doesn't want to. Okay. Pretend nothing happened. There we go. full screen Mary Jo. No one knows that Paul Theriot disappeared briefly.
Did you My cat came in.
Oh,
you know what happened? If my cat was going to have a little kitty heart attack if I didn't let her in my office, she's like freaking out.
I thought you were getting your harmonica.
She is like a harmonica. You can hear. You can probably hear. So loud.
Sorry, Mary Jo. Continue, please.
Yes. So, so anyway, the part I'm trying to bring out here, because everybody was so so desperately trying to say, look how great they did with devices and look how great they did with the cloud. Actually, they did. They did have an amazing quarter, which really surprised a lot of people on Wall Street, I think. But they had an amazing quarter mostly because of their enterprise business.
Yeah.
And that's not bad. I mean, they don't want to be IBM, but man, they do pretty darn well selling to businesses.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise anybody's paying attention at all.
Yeah, true.
It does make one wonder, though, if the Windows 8.1 strategy is quite the thing for that segment.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right. You know, it's funny on 8.1. I've often described 8.1 as being this, you know, an improvement over 8.8, which of course it is. And that the way you describe that improvement is to say it's interesting because for the people that use desktop computers, traditional computers, that don't have multi-touch interfaces, they've made it better, you know, to use it just in the desktop. It, they don't completely eliminate the Metro stuff, but they mostly eliminate it. I thought that was kind of a good step. You know, for people that do want to use Windows on a tablet, they also made it better for those people, right? Because it, you don't have to go to the control panel of the desktop as often as you did in the 8.0 release. But, you know, it's funny, like, that's one measure of success, but the place where Windows 8.1 is no more successful than 8, when it, you know, when you think about it, is in the integration of those two environments, right? It still leaves Windows as this thing that is two separate environments sitting on the same computer. And if anything, you know, Windows 8.1 made that divide even more pronounced, right? You know, because neither, you know, Metro is not particularly well suited for the desktop, and the desktop is not particularly well suited for multi-touch. It's right. Kind of an interesting thing. So I think, you know, in Update 1 and in Windows 9, however they do it, they're going to have to address that issue as well. My cat is freaking out.
Uh-oh.
She needs to be petted badly. As you can see her.
Does it... Do the results tell us anything about the direction Microsoft is taking, should be taking, should not be taking? Is Xbox, does this mean Xbox isn't important, for instance? It seems to me you, even if your revenue is enterprise bound, that you have to always be looking at other categories. You can't sit on rest on your laurels, right?
Correct, correct. And you know, they did have a really great quarter for Xbox. As well, they in fact when they put out their press release on earnings, Xbox was one of the big things they touted how well they did with that, and they should have since that was the holiday quarter and when they launched Xbox One.
What does that mean? You know, I mean, how did Xbox One contribute in a positive way to the bottom line at Microsoft in that quarter?
Right.
How could it?
I think they basically said thanks to the strength of sales of Xbox One and Surface, Microsoft had a blockbuster quarter, and it's like
they didn't tell you how much.
That's not exactly true, is it? I mean, you know.
No, well, okay, it contributed to their revenues in a very positive way.
They can't lie in the, but they could, but they could. Can they misrepresent? That's not quite strong. That's too strong.
They can choose to highlight what they want.
Highlight what you choose. Right. There you go. They can spin it.
Yeah.
Because yes,
they
did.
How many surfaces they sold?
No. I mean, they told us what Surface revenues were, though, right? They actually said they were close to $900 million. Is that right, Paul?
I'm kind of blanking it out, even though it was a week ago.
$893 million worth of Surfaces. Although they didn't break out how many units that was, and then you know again. They can still talk very positively about the contribution to the revenues that these products are making, like Xbox and Surface. Geez,
can they, though?
But
I mean, what were the revenues of the iPad at Apple in the same quarter?
Yeah, I know. Right.
Tens of billions?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. You know, some crazy amount.
They're starting small and working their way up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did some crazy math. I don't know if you saw that.
I know.
The,
I did
attempting
see your math.
To figure out the ASP, which is just a wonderful episode for someone who's math challenged.
Average selling price, right?
Because you have to, because Surface means the devices, but it also means the hardware, you know, the accessories. They mentioned that most of the sales were RT devices, not meaning Surface RT, but Surface RT and Surface 2. So you can make some assumptions there about, you know, which were the, you know, what percentage they sold of each type of device, what the average selling price of those, whether they've got a keyboard or other accessory, and, you know, okay, so how many Surfaces did they sell? Not that many. You know, I mean, right. I came up with about 1.5 million units.
1.5 yeah. million. Huh. What does that mean? Yeah.
Well, it means that Apple sold 26 million iPads, and you can do the math there, I guess. I mean, it, yeah, that's what it means.
Microsoft's never said what the metric for a success would be in this case. Right. At least they're not taking a $900 million write-off.
That's true.
They're selling them. Do you think that number is high, low, good, bad? Disappointing, satisfying?
I think it's disappointing, personally. But, one of the issues that they had with Surface over that quarter was that they weren't available.
Right.
I was getting emails the entire month of December and into this month, right? I mean, when did Surface 2 finally come back?
Right.
Last week?
Right. They make money on them, right? I mean, it's not one of them we're selling it at cost items, is it?
Yeah, Leo, sure they do.
Office and Windows are the traditional profit centers for Microsoft, right?
And even more recently, server and tools business was the biggest profit center, which is Windows Server and System Center and Visual Studio.
Still
all
the
those
case?
Products.
Still the case?
Yes.
Yes.
That is still the case.
You know, I was talking the other day, I've been talking about this kind of a lot lately, thinking about the idea of platforms and thinking about the history of Microsoft, which, you know, and I had this discussion with Dvorak, who as usual kind of disagreed, but that the boom of the computer industry in the 80s and 90s was, I think, almost entirely attributable to the fact that Microsoft provided a stable platform developers could write to. It was a known platform. You knew what you were writing for. You knew that they had a huge installed user base. Microsoft preserved legacy compatibility all along for those 20 years. I mean, they really did a good job in that respect. I guess 90s and 2000s. Maybe would be the right decades for that. And but the world's changed. Microsoft's recognizing that. And it is, in fact, the cloud that is the new platform, is it not?
It's not, one of them. I mean, I think mobile devices are.
Yeah, I guess mobile.
But, although I guess in many ways, most mobile apps are just front ends to online services.
Cloud, yeah. And it started with Amazon Web Services. In fact, I'm reading this.
It really is the Netscape thing. You know, I always go back to this. And I really didn't respect Mark Andreessen too much when Netscape was a thing. And, you know, he was talking about how they were going to reduce Windows to a buggy set of device drivers on which their right. you know, kind of what we would now call like a cloud OS would run.
Right.
I mean, I think there's something to that. I think the shock for Microsoft over the past 10 years has been that it's that traditional plan that you were just talking about where they would respect backwards compatibility and customers would just kind of move along with them. Kind of came to a crashing halt, and you know,
exactly.
It started with the Apple stuff, right? Because here were these new platforms that weren't compatible with anything, and things like that never took off before,
right?
And you know, you can kind of argue about why, we could discuss that, but I mean, I think that was the big affront, you know, to Microsoft.
So it became very clear that there's the enterprise cloud, but there's this larger cloud as a platform for everybody. You know, which right. Google's promoting with Chromebooks, of course. And I think you nailed it, Paul, when you said that mobile devices are really just a front end to cloud computing. Amazon kind of began this era with Amazon Web Services, Elastic Computing Cloud, S3 storage. Microsoft and Google both are trying to, you know, and actually have parity, I think, now. Microsoft.
It's just
first.
Funny how this technology... It's weird. It like kind of subverts the historic strength of Microsoft because it makes the PC and the server less relevant. You know, that when you can cheaply virtualize a server up in some cloud service rather than in your own expensive data center, that's actually a big benefit to
but
customers.
It's and commoditized, right? I mean,
It makes that thing that was Microsoft's kind of bread and butter less viable.
And a lot of companies, HP, Rackspace, Google, they're talking about OpenStack now. These are not running. They're running on open source software.
Well, the thing is, when you run stuff locally, that's when you have the sort of historical backwards compatibility is important.
Right.
When you run it up in a service, you know, switching between platforms is no longer a big deal because you're not doing the heavy lifting anymore.
It's trivial.
You know?
And it has, in the same way that in the 90s and the 2000s, Microsoft powered an entire economy forward. The cloud has done that dramatically. A startup starts in these shared systems that are cheap.
Leo, Microsoft's slogan at one time, remember, was a computer on every desk in every home, that kind of thing.
Running Windows software. Microsoft software.
Running Windows software. Yeah. But that must have seemed so forward-leaning in the 1980s or whenever they came up with that. That sounds ludicrously old-fashioned today.
It does, doesn't it?
A computer it on a desk in my house? Why would I want that? That's amazing. It is profound how big of a change.
So no wonder Microsoft's struggling a little bit with this.
Well, as it turns out,
Making money.
I think this quarter does show that
they're still making money.
They're still making a lot of money. Yeah. And the way that they're doing it is by, I think, successfully transitioning the businesses that they can from on-prem software to services.
And that's what I was leading up to with this ridiculously circuitous route is what is the report card on that?
I think they're doing great. In that transition. But I think more just to kind of step back a second, Mary Jo and I write about Microsoft, but really we kind of write about Windows in the sense that Windows is the center of everything, you know? It's not anymore. And that's the weirdest transition of all. Because Microsoft can still be very successful without the Windows desktop being very successful. Right. But it's so weird because Windows was at the center of it all for so long. It was the catalyst for everything else that happened there.
Huge change.
So I think we tend to focus on that stuff and maybe over-focus on it because it's been such a constant for 20 years, 20 plus years, you know. But it's changing. Yep. And it's weird. It's hard. You know, it's a hard transition.
Yep. Do they break out the cloud stuff, Mary Jo? Is that...
They give you some very vague ideas. Like they'll say we doubled licenses sold compared to last quarter, but we don't know what the number of sold was last quarter, so we don't really know.
Yeah,
which makes it tricky.
Yeah,
the one number they did break out, which was interesting, was Office 365 Home Premium sales. They actually are at 3.5 million subscribers for that now, and that is one of their cloud services.
That sounds pretty good.
It is. That's actually very good. It's what that one is Microsoft selling to customers on a subscription basis the right to install Office 2013 on up to 5 PCs or Macs.
That's the one so I have. And it's what, $10 a month? What is it? I can't even remember now.
Yeah, it's roughly that. It's $99 a year.
So that's a significant, you're talking some money here.
Right.
Yep.
But they did admit that the one reason that did so well was they started cannibalizing their own non-subscription Office business.
But of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Right. It's not a big surprise.
I don't know if you caught this. I don't know where this popped up, but I guess they also said that the business versions, were now on a $1.5 billion revenue run rate.
Wow.
And that this is the fastest growing, commercial product in their history now.
That's Office 365, the business ones, right?
Yeah.
Nope, I didn't see that number.
Yeah, one in four of all business customers, of all their business customers, have Office 365. And 60% of the Fortune 500 has purchased Office 365 in the past year.
So that's good. That means that this transition to the subscription model is working well. I mean, if you're saying 25%, have adopted this. That's for the first year. I think that's good, right?
I think so.
That's very good. That means this new model for software, which is really software as a service practically, is succeeding. That's got to be good news for Microsoft. So is this kind of a stalking horse for Windows becoming a subscription product? I think it is. Microsoft's always wanted to do that.
Yeah.
And they do already in enterprise, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, if you talk about, cloud, the word cloud means so many things. If you talk about it as a subscription and say, hey, what if we let you buy 5 Windows licenses that you could install on any of your family's PCs if you pay us, however, $99 a year, whatever. That's Office. I mean, that's Windows as a subscription, just like Office, right?
Sure.
They could do that. Why not?
I wish they would.
Or
really,
right,
why?
Or you
why
do something.
Why? Well, why do you want?
Time, I think this is the time where Windows is kind of hitting a shortfall, and you've got all these 400 million XP users that aren't upgrading anytime soon, and I don't think this would help businesses per se, but just making Windows more easily and cheaply licensable, and providing that same benefit to families that they do with Office, I think is just a no-brainer.
Remember, though, that in the Windows, well, I don't remember. I'm not. I shouldn't be telling you. You should be telling me. But
do tell me.
In the Windows world, I'm just thinking now there's business and there's consumers, but in both cases, I think the sense that you get is you buy the computer with Windows. And you don't upgrade Windows until you buy the next computer.
Yeah.
So what am I paying for with a subscription? And why should I pay anything?
Sure.
It's already,
you're
bought the
computer. You're competing with devices that get upgrades for free forever.
Right.
Well, or for some period of time.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, right.
So how do you move from that model?
How do you move from it or to it, do you mean?
To the subscription model, from the model, which I think exists right now, at least in my mind, that I don't buy Windows. I buy a computer with Windows on it, and I don't buy another copy of Windows until I buy the next computer. In fact, I don't even ever buy it. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly the consumer mindset. Is it also the business mindset?
Yeah. Definitely.
Except for the giant enterprises where they're buying, volume licenses and all that.
Well, this is another issue, though, I think, in businesses where they don't want to disrupt operations. I mean, one of we ran into this with the Surface stuff that we'll talk about later, where constant updates is a great idea, Constant upgrades that actually work and don't impact the reliability of the system is a much better idea.
Much better, yeah.
And that's the thing. We still, enterprise customers, business customers, these are the guys that would never upgrade until SP1 in the old days and then got burned by service packs and, didn't want to upgrade ever. And that's why we have XP. It's a tough thing to get from here to there.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a business customer and Microsoft says to you, okay, how about if you buy Windows on a subscription? It's almost like software assurance then, right? Like you tell us that we'll give you every update and point release that we do in some set period, like 3 years for software assurance. And that guarantees you get everything.
Right.
So that's another way you come at it.
Kind of have that, don't they? I mean, yeah. One of the issues that comes up with this XP expiration thing, right, which is like the great story of our age, is, who are these 400 million customers? Like, who are these people, that haven't upgraded?
Yeah.
And I've heard from, readers in my comments section and via email, like, why does Microsoft care about these people? They're not good customers. They're still running XP. The thing is, I actually think that most of those customers are, in fact, business customers and are good Microsoft customers, and that they do have access to newer versions of Windows. Not all of them, but some significant percentage through software assurance or volume licensing, and that they have not upgraded because they can't, or they perceive that they can't, because they have these legacy applications or web apps or intranet sites or whatever it is that for whatever reason doesn't work in a modern web browser or a modern version of Windows or whatever, and that they're kind of stuck on XP for the same reason that people have always been stuck on old versions of software. It's just,
I don't want to buy a new piece of hardware. And
I don't know. I mean, I'm just speculating, but I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of those guys were, in fact, what we might call good Microsoft customers, in the sense that they are paying for SA, volume licensing, whatever, but they just can't make that move.
In the consumer space, and maybe the consumer space doesn't matter. Okay.
Screw those guys.
Does the consumer space matter?
If you're at home
anymore?
Running XP, I mean, come on. Seriously?
But that's probably most of them, right?
Listen, you got to come out of your cabin in the woods and realize the 80s are over. It's time to upgrade.
I don't think it's as, I mean, I think it's a mix of those kind of people who just are too cheap, like we've talked about before. Yeah. And then there's people who really can't move because of peripherals, software applications they built, people who built apps that are dependent on Internet Explorer 6, like all those people. It's like, you want to encourage them to move, obviously, so that they aren't going to be infected by any kind of a massive security issue once Microsoft stops updating XP. But I also kind of feel for them. It's like they're stuck, right?
They're literally stuck. I mean, I think that's the important part. They're literally stuck. And they're not always running ancient hardware. I mean, I remember back in the Windows 7 days when that was first coming out, one of the big concerns then was XP. And, you know, one of the things they did with Windows 7 was make sure that it ran really well on older hardware. And, you know, there were all these stories about companies buying Windows 7 class PCs and wiping it out and putting Windows XP on it because they needed it for backwards compatibility, hopefully. I mean, hopefully they weren't just doing it because they didn't want to train people how to use
it. I like XP. It's a good little operating system.
I like that silver UI that you can put on. It's nice.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I do like that, actually.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not just like stubbornness, right? I mean, I think, you know, most Office Windows, whatever, you can make a case. Look, I'm not upgrading to the next version because this thing I have works fine. And version to version, there isn't enough of an advance, you know, whatever. And then two versions go by. And you're like, yeah, I'm still not doing it. I got this. And 3-4 versions later, it's like, guys, seriously. I mean, you're running software that is out of date. Like, it's really out of date. It's insecure. So there's got to be a reason. And it's got to be this application compatibility stuff.
The fixer in the chat room, and again, this is consumers, but he says, I have a customer who's trying to get her to update. She's a home PC user. She said, no, I paid $2,500 for this PC 11 years ago, and that's that. Wow. I ain't buying another one. I hear from people on the radio show all the time. Admittedly, a lot of it is line of business software that won't work on anything but XP, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Although, that's why Microsoft put XP in Windows 7, right? So you could run it in emulation and run your line of business software.
We got to do like a car years thing, right? It's be like driving around in a car from the 1950s that didn't have headrest, didn't have airbags, didn't have seatbelts.
But it looks good.
You know, didn't have any. You know, like, yeah, it, you may still like the way it's still, the styling is there. I get it. You know, but
it still drives. You know,
it still drives.
It still drives.
Right,
there was nothing wrong with this car.
So what if I need leaded gas? Look, it still drives. Yeah,
but the computers is worse because, really, truthfully, computer hardware does not wear out. And the only thing that wears out is the hard drive. People replace those.
Yeah. Stupid, reliable computers.
Damn them.
It is a strange problem.
I mean, you know, iPads that are only 3 years old have been obsoleted by Apple. Sure. I don't hear the hue and cry around that, which you ought to hear.
Right. They're a unique company. I mean, you know, in the old days, you could make the case that their user base was fairly small, so they put up with this kind of aggressive obsoleting of older technology.
But not true anymore.
Today, you can't say that anymore. And they've just established this thing where people love to spend money on that stuff.
So
you know, and
to my question, does Microsoft not worry about the consumer market and just go full speed ahead on enterprise, or are they unwilling to give that cash cow up?
No, it's more when I actually got to ask Steve Ballmer that question last year. And I said, why don't you just focus on the enterprise? That's where you're killing.
Right.
And he said they believe in the consumerization of IT, that people are bringing their own devices to work.
BYOD killed them.
Right. They believe in that. And so because they believe in that, they believe they can't just leave the consumer market because that'll be their death knell if they do that.
What? You know, there's an even worse version of BYOD.
What's that?
It's called BYOE. And that is bring your own everything.
Right?
It's like once, in other words, in the old days, you would bring in an iPod or something, and that was kind of radical. And they started like super gluing USB ports so you couldn't attach it to your computer.
Right.
Today, you know, a lot of people have their own smartphone, their own tablet, their own computer, you know, and you can do various mobile device management things to, you know, connect those to your corporate infrastructure and so forth. But the everything bit, I believe, refers to literally everything else, like Dropbox, you know, consumer services in many ways that are now being meshed with this stuff that is like corporate data.
And, you know, I understand because the consumer looks at Dropbox and says, I can use this. I understand it. And this share file or whatever, it's complicated. My
VPN is terrible to get into, and I can only do it from my PC.
Yeah.
But if I take those corporate files and I put them in my Dropbox, then I can get to them from my phone or from my tablet or from whatever.
Right.
And you can sort of see the pragmatism of that, but you also have to sort of think about the dark side of that.
Well, the poor IT department, for one thing.
Yep.
They've completely lost control.
Yep.
Yeah. I think Ballmer's answer makes sense. You know, BYOD is something that killed them. It brought the iPhone into the market, into the business. Well,
they really are embracing it, though.
They are.
Hey, how's Nokia doing? I think you have Nokia quarterly results as well, right?
Yeah.
Who?
That was a weird one. I know.
Leo, NSN is going like gangbusters. Actually, I found their quarterly earnings to be interesting on a number of levels. Obviously, what we were looking for was how well did Lumia do, and you know all that kind of stuff. And
because Microsoft's, when does the transition occur?
Sometime
it's supposed to be this quarter.
Soon, yeah.
Yeah.
It's all the regulatory approvals gone through, so we're just waiting for the other shoe to drop now.
Waiting for China still, I think.
Oh, China, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
But if you looked at their actual earnings report, I mean, they all of a sudden in this quarter pretended that these businesses don't exist anymore. It was really funny. They changed it over to as if they had gotten rid of their hardware and services businesses. And you know, I can't remember the exact language they used, but they basically referred to them as like their legacy businesses. You know, the thing that we think of is when we think of Nokia is going away. It's going to Microsoft. So.
Yeah, I think it's important. I always say this wrong. They didn't buy Nokia. They bought Nokia's phone business.
No, they bought Nokia. They bought the soul of Nokia. I mean, come on.
No, come on.
Well, that's like what Nokia's at pains to say.
Back there. It's like, you know, they have a hero mapping business that is good for tens, possibly hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue a year. And
but
you know,
how about
NSN
their patent
business.
Licensing business?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, no, that's probably worth something.
Yeah.
But come on, patent licensing? I mean, I'd rather talk about Yahoo than talk about a patent licensing company. I mean, you know, there's not
a lot.
A lot
of money, especially if they start suing people over their own patents.
That's right. Could be big business.
I know. It's a weird thing, but yeah, could be a big business for them.
So I think the Lumia stuff is actually okay. I don't know how this started to happen, and I don't know that this was the first time, but it was weird that people focused on the fact that quarter over quarter, Lumia sales actually dropped. That's not usually how you measure such things. You usually compare them year over year. And year over year, they were up pretty big, actually. And that's been the trend for them ever since they released the first Lumia. This is not the first time Nokia sold fewer Lumias quarter over quarter. So it's not even like notable in that sense. That has happened in the past. But, you know, the big question here, of course, is Microsoft is going to suck this stuff in, and what's it going to look like on the other side? And a lot of 30,000-plus employees, I think, are coming to Microsoft. They obviously have manufacturing facilities, design facilities, employees of all stripes, you know, who do different things. They've got devices that they're going to announce, no doubt, next month at Mobile World Congress. I mean, I don't know. Right now, Microsoft sells two Surfaces and an Xbox, and in a month or two, they're going to have 81 Nokia stuff. Devices. Yeah, a lot of stuff.
I know. Yeah. It's going to be interesting, right? How this all shakes out and how Microsoft deals with the branding, Nokia versus Lumia versus Asha. There's all those rumors out there where we keep seeing screenshots of some kind of a phone that's based on Android that is supposedly an Asha phone. It supposedly is called the Nokia X. Based on things that Ev Leaks has been publishing. So, yeah, there's a lot of big question marks about how their product lines are going to integrate once they do become a single company. And then, you know, it was funny to see when Nokia announced that their Windows Phone sales for that quarter were off from the previous quarter. I saw a few people saying, you know what, I wonder if they did this intentionally because no one wanted to say, we had to sell to Microsoft because we had such a successful business. So they had to show they had an unsuccessful business. So I was oh no.
That's, there you go.
That's like tinfoil hat time, right?
Yep.
But I saw people saying that. I was like, I don't know. That's going a little far, but yeah. The two numbers, though, that were hard to reconcile, I don't know if you saw this, Paul. Joe Belfiore came onto Twitter after Nokia's numbers came out and said, well, we had a really huge quarter for Windows Phone activations in the fourth calendar quarter. So people were trying to make sense of that. It's like, if this was the most Windows Phone activations that ever were, how could Nokia actually have sold fewer Windows phones? Because Nokia Windows phones are like 80 or 90% of the whole Windows Phone base.
I'm just going to give a theory because I actually have no idea.
Me neither.
I wonder if Nokia doesn't register a sale where Microsoft does when they sell it into the channel, and that those devices have been sitting in, you know, distribution centers or retailers. Yep. And then they were sold in the fourth quarter.
That could be.
To customers. Right. I mean, so maybe some of the sales we saw from Q3 last year were, in fact, delivered to customers in Q4.
Yeah. Just a guess. That could be.
All right. I don't know how long the show has been because a lot of it has been us messing around with Mary Jo. But we're going to.
It's been 7.5 minutes so far.
Yeah, we've only really done a few things. But I do want to take a little break. Paul Theriot, Mary Jo Foley. We're talking about Microsoft and Windows. Windows 8.1 update 1 inches closer. We'll talk about that. Surface, those updates just keep on coming. Office, Windows Phone, Cortana, perhaps. All coming up in just a bit. Our show today brought to you by our good friends at ShareFile. I saw the yes. Squarespace is coming up in a second. ShareFile is the place to share files. We were talking about this a bit ago. This is kind of the best of both worlds. It's from Citrix, and it's business focused. So it's a very easy way to share files without emailing them. Business appropriate, but as easy to use as some of those consumer solutions. It's a great kind of... In fact, there's an Outlook plugin that makes it look just like you're attaching to an email. Obviously, you don't want to email attachments, although nowadays in business, practically every business email includes some sort of attachment, a PowerPoint presentation or spreadsheet, a contract, some document or some other. That's not the way to do it. It's not secure. Anybody can read it along the way. It's also prone to bounce backs because you don't know how much... You know, how big a file their email client can handle or their email provider can handle. In some cases, there's still plenty of email accounts that limit you to 10 megabytes for the whole inbox. This is why ShareFile is the must way to share in business. ShareFile from Citrix lets you send attachments as secure links. You could send files of virtually any size, giant files, with the highest degree of security. You'll get notifications when your files have been opened and by whom. ShareFile is easy to use. It integrates into any business. Plus, with ShareFile, you can access your own files anywhere, laptop, tablet, or smartphone. So it's cloud storage, too. Happens to me all the time. I use ShareFile to share audio files with the radio stations. You know, hi, this is Leo Laporte. Whenever I'm in Tucson, I'm listening to the radio, whatever that is. And so we send those to the local radio stations via ShareFile. They get a link. They don't need to have a ShareFile account. They don't need to log in. They just click the link, download the file. It's very easy for them. It's very easy for me to keep track of what they're doing. I can expire those files. Like I said, that's only good for a month or a year, or it never expires. I can say how many times they can download it. Just fabulous. If you have, and by the way, what I do is I have a ShareFile folder that automatically syncs with the ShareFile app into. I could just put the files in the folder and then I have them on my phone. If I forget, for instance, and this happens all the time, I go home and forget to mail the file out. I just launch it on my ShareFile app on my phone, and I can see all the files and send them along. I love ShareFile. If you're not using it, I want you to sign up for your free trial now. If you go to ShareFile.com, you'll see three places where it says try it free. Only one of them helps me. So don't click the big green button that says start your free trial. Don't click the menu item that says try it free. Go way up here. This little tiny... I really wish they'd make this bigger. This little tiny text that says podcast listeners... Click here and that little microphone, if you would. I know, please. Just do me a favor. Click that link. And when they ask, say Windows as the code. That way everybody will know where you heard it. And it would help us greatly if you'd do that. Start your free trial. 30 days free. Use the offer code Windows. Make sure to click that microphone in the upper top of the page so that you can... start your free trial right now. You don't even need a credit card for this. ShareFile.com. I see they just won a Tabby Award for Best Data Access and Collection App. Is that your cat, Paul, that gives the Tabby Awards?
It should be.
ShareFile.com. We thank their ShareFile for their support of Windows Weekly. Windows 8.1 Update 1, the latest news.
Yes, the latest news is if Microsoft holds to its current plan, we may see this sooner than a lot of us were thinking. It may actually come out on March 11th, which is Patch Tuesday. So, that's kind of curious, too. There were rumors that Microsoft might deliver Update 1 via Windows Update, but I was kind of waiting to see. But now I'm hearing from my contacts, yes, that is the plan, really? And that's how they're going to get it out to people.
So next month, or 2 months, I guess, it'll show up. Mm-hmm. Will it show up as a critical update? Will it show up as an optional update? I presume it'll be optional.
Yeah, I've heard optional update on March 11th, and then the next month on Patch Tuesday, which I think is April 8th or April 9th, it could show up as a critical update. Or at least important. I don't know if it'll be critical.
They'll never require it, will they? Or will they?
Hmm. Good question.
But traditionally, Microsoft's not done that.
Sorry.
That's okay. Part of it?
Yeah, traditionally, an update like that is...
Yeah, I mean, somebody told me that this thing was basically analogous to what we used to call a feature pack.
Right.
And that the distinction here is that service packs are obviously to fix problems. And a feature pack, or what we now are calling an update for some reason, is more of a functional update. And, with service packs, they reach a point where the support for the OS requires a certain service pack level, right? So, Windows 7, they only released one, but it would be Windows 7 with service pack 1. You know, XP today through April is service pack 3. I actually would be... I don't think Windows 8.1 will be around enough for it to matter or whatever, but I wouldn't be surprised if this became what constituted, the base install of Windows going forward until Windows 9 ships or whatever. I mean, so in that sense, I think you're going to get this on new computers and all that kind of stuff. In fact, I think somebody told me that was the case.
So the new computers will ship with Update 1 starting
March, whenever.
Whenever.
Yeah.
April. And you'll be getting it as a update in March and maybe required or critical in April.
I wouldn't be surprised if it became critical over time.
Yeah. Well, there are some security things in it. It's not merely a feature pack. There are some.
Actually, that I don't know.
Yeah. So you don't want to require a feature pack. It's just a feature pack.
Yeah.
Take the features.
Take it.
I mean, the reason you might want to require it is because of some of the things that are in there in terms of how apps are going to now behave. It's going to change. So if you're trying to standardize on a version of Windows 8, or you're a developer and you're trying to build for the operating system, you want to make sure everybody is kind of on the same page as to how apps open, how they work. So I can see why they might do that. It's not as far-fetched, I think, as it might seem.
What are some of the you're getting some leaks now on some of the features of Update 1. I'm sorry, not Service Pack 1. Update 1 to 8.1. Right. Paul, I saw you had an article on the mouse.
Yeah, and I it's hard to keep track of when this stuff happened, but a week or so ago we had written some stuff about some leaks at the time, and I talked to a source at Microsoft. He told me a couple of things, and one of them didn't make sense to me. And so I wrote about the other, and the other had to do with mouse usage in Windows 8.1 and so forth. But he was talking about this notion that there would be these context menus, and he specifically said apps, And the way I took that, although I didn't write about it at the time because it wasn't making sense to me, but he said they had a very crude context menu and that you could right-click with the mouse, and instead of it bringing up the normal Metro UI, which is those app bars, it brings up like a menu like you would see on the desktop. And it turns out this is, in fact, exactly what's happening. But it's for the start screen and for the apps screen, right, which is that thing that's below the start screen.
Right.
So when he said apps, he meant the apps screen, not apps. So when you go into an app and you right-click, the app bar will come up. So what I had originally written in this article was that they were going to be adding this feature to apps, like applications. And
within
that's not
an
the case.
App, no.
Yeah.
So you know, I like this behavior on the start screen and apps menu, I guess, because in the past, you know, it's been this kind of non-intuitive. You drag it down and you do this this little doodly dance with touch.
I like this, too, because people that use a mouse are used to this behavior.
This
in
is
fact,
how it should be, yeah.
I would argue that they should, in fact, add this to apps.
I agree.
In applications, and that it's something they could do seamlessly without any interaction from developers because
I could right
they know
click
what
on a,
buttons will come up.
Right.
Why not just put them in a menu?
Put them there. Yeah. I can right-click on a tile on the start screen now and unpin it directly from the context menu that pops up, or pin it, or uninstall
because
it, or resize it.
Now those things are disconnected. You know, You go up to a tile, and maybe the tile is way up in the right corner of the screen, and you right-click on it to select it. To perform an action on that thing, you then have to move the mouse all the way down to the lower left corner right. where those options are. It's a weirdism of the Metro thing that, you know, it works okay when you're holding a device and you're touching it, but it makes no sense with a mouse.
If I press and hold, will I get the same context menu with my finger?
The mouse?
With my finger?
Oh, no. I think this is mouse only.
Mouse only.
Right. Yeah. A lot of the things in this update are meant specifically for mouse users.
Yeah, that we've seen, yeah.
Mousers. Yeah, mousers.
Is it too much for me to, okay, am I completely off base? But if, okay, press and hold should be the same as a right click.
That is roughly true, right. Yes.
Yeah. So shouldn't a context menu pop up if I press and hold?
No, because that's a mouse interface. That's what I mean. Like, I think the thing that's nice about this is that it respects the interaction type. So if you press and hold on a tile, let me just bring this up on a touch screen so I can actually do that and not just talk about it. You know, if you, it's kind of strange because, yeah, if you press and hold, it brings up the normal, you know, the app bar interface, which is normal. Because I think when you think about the way multi-touch works, it's not like there's not a screen floating in space where you're touching it with a finger. Usually you're holding it, right? So when you're holding it, your one finger is near where those options are going to be. So if you're using this finger to select stuff, you have this other hand over here that typically is going to be where those options are. And so
the app bar is not going away. It will still be there in touch. But when you're using a mouse, you can also...
That's what I mean. It's context sensitive in the sense that depending on what type of input device you're using, it acts differently. But only the start menu and the app screen. It's a step, Leo.
Yeah. It's the a other step. Thing they're another
the journey is the
change.
Reward, Leo.
I like that they're putting the power button and the search button up near where
the user
your name is, right? Where the
why,
user
is. Is there room for a clock over there? Because I don't understand.
Oh, I would love to have a clock on there.
The start That'd screen doesn't awesome. Have a clock.
I know. It's so annoying. Crazy. So annoying.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're doing lots of things to make it easier for people who are traditional, quote, desktop mouse keyboard users to feel more at home with Windows 8. Update one. One thing they're doing under the covers that is more of an OEM feature is they're going to reduce the memory and the disk space requirements for Windows, supposedly as part of this update too. And that's not something that users are going to care or see as much. It's more meant to make the operating system work better on cheaper, smaller tablets. So it's more...
Well, also, just to prevent that, you know, SSD shock thing that occurs when you buy a 32 gig storage and have 11 gigs free, you know, whatever the number is.
Right.
I think that's because that's been, you know, that's been a big stink with the Surface devices in particular, but the other Windows devices, you know, 32, 64 gigs of storage, you get the thing home and there's no free space.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So shrinking that footprint.
Yep.
Yep.
So, yeah, the game plan is March 11th. Things can change still. If they, you know, decide it's not ready, they could push it back till the April patch Tuesday. But right now, that's supposedly the target, the ship target.
Surface, which is not the opposite of dive. Maybe it is the same. I don't know. More updates. You call it, Paul, the worst month ever for Surface updates. So
well, I mean, it's been so stupid.
There have been a lot
it's like
of updates to the updates.
I feel like a lot of positive things have happened at Microsoft over the past year, you know? And this Surface, like, lack of communication thing is like the whole Sinofsky era all over again.
Yeah.
You know, I just feel bad about it. It was so unnecessary. They really kind of shot themselves in the foot
so
there.
So Mary Jo has wrapped it all up and explained to us all what the hell happened.
I tried. Although today I found out there's some things I have to change in that article yet again.
Oh, man. You just published it yesterday.
I know.
Is it February yet?
No. Yeah. Yeah. So here's one of the reasons this is so complicated. Microsoft is updating four different Surfaces, or Surfi, or whatever we call them. Surface Pro 2, Surface Pro, Surface 2, and Surface RT, which they call just the plain old Surface now. And some of these are running Windows 8.1, and some are running Windows 8.0. I can imagine this could get even more complicated when we have Update 1 come out. So they're updating all these things differently based on which operating system on which hardware you're running. So not everybody gets the same set of updates across all of these devices. Each one of these different configurations gets different updates. So if you look at my list, there's things they updated on the Surface Pro 2 that are different from what they did on the Surface Pro, that are different from what they did on Surface 2. We've gone over a lot of these on previous episodes of Windows Weekly, but the main thing to know about the Surface Pro 2, which I just found out today, is there was one firmware update that went out this month for everybody for Surface Pro 2, whether you got the faulty December firmware update or you didn't. Everybody now supposedly has the same firmware update fix as of January on their machines.
Right on, Daddy-O.
How confident do you feel about that one?
I don't just curious. Feel
that kind of hesitantly, yeah.
I don't know. It seems like something you should be able to say confidently, but
we've heard so many different iterations of this story, right? From at first it was like some people were getting one patch and some were getting a different patch, and then some people also are getting things called hardware updates, which I found out today are just driver updates.
That's not hardware.
Right. I know. How disappointing.
Yeah.
I guess you can't really push the hardware.
I was just staring at it like it's like waiting for toast to happen. Yeah. You know, maybe the hardware will change in front of my eyes.
My screen resolution has doubled.
My Surface Pro got thinner.
Thank you, Microsoft.
Yeah.
It's a miracle.
So anyway, the good news is we're almost done with January, so at least the January updates are done. But there should be some more February ones coming.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
Yeah. The one thing that did not get fixed, by the way, in this month of updates, because I've had a few people ask me about this, was there's a micro SD card issue for the Surface Pro 2. And I believe that none of the updates that anybody got fixed that.
What is the issue?
Something to do with battery life, I believe, or when you have a micro SD card in, somehow your battery drops to zero, I'm thinking.
Wow.
I can't remember exactly, although I bet somebody in the chat room will. But yeah, whatever that micro SD card was, if I could find my article. I wrote so many articles on Surface updates this month, I can't even find all of my articles.
It's so hard to write about. It's like, okay, I thought I covered everything.
But we haven't.
He's the little search doggy when you need him.
I know.
You look like you're looking for articles. Can I
Where's
help?
Clippy? I know.
I want my Clippy. I need my articles.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, that's it for your Surface. All your updates should be out this month, and supposedly they're getting it back on track. Let's see.
And what is this Windows 2-in-1 PC?
So this is sort of the general term that people use to describe actually like a Surface device, right? It's a
tablet and a computer.
Yeah, and they take different forms. I actually tend to think of them as hybrid PCs, but that picture there is like a Lenovo Yoga type machine where the screen flips over.
Right.
And you don't detach the screen from the keyboard, but it still becomes sort of a tablet.
It's
a picture frame.
It's a laptop.
Yeah. Yep. It's a floor wax. It's all those things.
Yeah.
And I'm curious. I mean, I'm going to be looking at these things again. I had sort of decided last year after a lot of back and forth in this, you know, the two generations of 2-in-1s that we saw. And, of course, mini tablets appeared last year finally as well. You know, I don't know. I mean, I always sort of saw this as the future of the PC and maybe more specifically the future of the Ultrabook. But it's interesting to me how much resistance there is with PC users for these kinds of devices. Actually, you know, Mary Jo's a good example of this. You know, she wants to get a... Yeah, you want a new computer. You're not interested in multi-touch. You don't care if the thing flips around and can be used as a tablet, you know. And I think that's the big question. You know, the problem here is, you know, if the 2-in-1 in PC is not the future of the PC, there is no future for the PC, right? I mean, what's the, you know, where do you go from here? I mean, basically, you just stick with the current designs and, you know, I don't know. It's kind of a low volume thing right there. But, you know, the 2-in-1s have not, to my mind, or at least from what I've seen, have not taken off in any appreciable way so far. Yeah. So I don't know. This is something I'm sort of openly wondering about.
Yeah. You know, I think it's like we talk about a lot on Windows Weekly. Everybody's use case of a PC is so different. For me, yeah. I need something that I can type on my lap with. And that's not something everybody needs, right? And even though Surface is supposed to be, quote, lappable, and a lot of these hybrid 2-in-1 things say that they also can be used on your lap, there's nothing as good on a lap for a lot of consistent typing as a PC, a clamshell PC. And so I know my use case is very different from a lot of people. How many other people sit, you know, for hours at a time typing? Yeah. Not that many, right? Yeah. So for me, that it makes sense.
If I think I had thrown this the notion of the Yoga by you actually recently and weren't interested because you heard it was, you know, a touch machine and could flip around and turn into a tablet. But I mean, does that make the device less viable? I mean, you don't have to use it in that way. I mean, even if, you know, you never know. I mean, it seems like just for testing purposes, it would be useful.
No.
So the next topic
I'm one of those people who I've never been a converged device person. Even I'm like somebody who still would prefer to use a Zune HD over a phone to listen to music because I think you should use the best tool for the best job. I still use my Paperwhite, my Kindle Paperwhite to read, even though I could read on my Surface. I don't know. And I know I'm not like everybody, but I just don't really want a device that's not good at one thing. I want something to be the best at the one thing.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
No, I wrote something very similar to this last year. I mean, I spent a lot of time fighting with this very issue. And, you know, as last year drew to a close, I mean, I still use the same non-multi-touch Ultrabook I've been using for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. If I want to read a book, I have a Kindle. If I want to watch a movie, I have a little tablet, you know, I have a smartphone, obviously, whatever. I mean, I guess it's a little ponderous having that many devices, but each of them seems to do something really well.
Yep. Yeah. You know, if you say, what's the future if it's not the 2-in-1? I say, why not? How about a future of at least one really, really great Ultrabook?
I agree.
That would be awesome. I would like to have that as an option and see some people do a little more innovation around Ultrabook.
Do those not exist? I mean,
they do. But, you know, I've been looking, as you guys know, because I brought it up on the show a lot, for the next PC that I want to buy. And I find a lot of different Ultrabooks, but there's always something wrong with each one. It's either they're so prohibitively expensive for what you get, or the battery life is like so-so because it has a touch screen that I don't really even care if I use.
The good ones are always very expensive. That's definitely true.
Well, so the Carbon Touch. You don't want touch. So the Carbon X1.
Yeah, Lenovo. Maybe.
What do you think?
Maybe.
But it's still, you know, $1,500, $2,000, depending on which one you get. They're expensive.
I don't mind, like I said before, I don't mind spending for something that's really great. But every time I come, when I do get to see one in a store somewhere, I always am like, oh, this one has really sharp edges, or this one doesn't bend back far enough. Yeah. There's always something about each one that makes me say, oh, I can't spend $2,000 if I don't love the thing.
I don't know. I mean, aside from my ambivalence about Samsung, I actually really like the Samsung that I do have. I think the modern versions of this now have super high res screens and multi-touch. I don't know that you can get one without the touch. I mean, although I don't think touch being on the screen is going to hurt the before, you know, it's not a flip around device. It's still like a laptop, you know?
Right. I mean,
they're expensive.
And I'm just kind of discouraged about the battery life on all these things, because it feels like since we've introduced a touch idea in Windows laptops, and I don't know if it's because of touch, if it's because of all the new sensors or what it's exactly because of, our battery life is getting worse instead of better. That's a problem.
You're right. Everything sucks.
Why are we in this business?
I'm holding out hope. I'm going to find a good laptop someday.
I think, you know, a nice MacBook Air would do you great. But
well, you know what? So here's the thing. So a couple problems there. MacBook Air, in theory, is a great machine. Two big problems. One is that sharpness of edge thing that she was talking about. Macs are awful for that, and the Air is particularly bad. The other one is it's a great laptop if you want Mac OS X, but if you want to run Windows, it will run Windows, but it does not run Windows well. And that great battery life you get Mac OS X disappears. You know, the efficiency is gone, and it's you know, a lot of it's not because Windows just sucks. It's because Apple, you know, provides these really substandard drivers, and there's no way to get around it. And it's just unfortunate. You know, I've heard many people say, oh, you know, the Macs, you know, Mac's a better PC than a PC. It's better for Windows. You know, it's not. It really isn't. And you'll get things like the fan kicking in all the time on a MacBook Air using Windows. That doesn't happen when you're running Mac OS X. Mm-hmm. It's just not an efficient way to do it. It's too bad, because I would do the same thing. I would have bought a MacBook Air, you know, a year and a half ago.
Yeah, I don't run a Windows on it primarily, so I don't have much experience.
No, it's nice that the option's there, but if you're going to run Windows, that's
not a good choice. Is the Acer Aspire S7 too expensive for you? This is my Windows machine, but it has touch. So would you not want, I mean, would you say I'm not going to buy it because it has touch, or are you just, no?
No, I would take it. Yeah. It just wouldn't be something I'm seeking out.
I would just never touch it.
Is this
I would probably never touch it.
It might be too sharp for you. It is so thin.
Yeah.
Is it?
Mm. It's like a, it's, that's why I like it. It's thinner than a MacBook Air.
Do you have it there with you now?
No, it's at
home.
Is
it in front of you? Yeah.
It's at home.
I mean, that's a pretty machine.
It's really beautiful. It's thin. Mm-hmm. These are Haswell. Some of the things I didn't like about the previous generation, they fixed the keyboard, the mouse. Mm-hmm. The screen is gorgeous. I think Ed Bot says that's a better laptop than the MacBook Air. So I would look at that one. I've been very happy with my S7. But I don't, I haven't tried a lot of them.
Yeah. You never can find the perfect machine, right? There's always going to be something.
I'm actually impressed by the variety and the quality of machines out there.
You're still running XP, are you, Mary Jo?
I am. Don't tell anybody.
What?
I knew it.
Is this why you're looking?
No,
you have a Windows 7.
I am looking because my laptop that I use on the road is a Core Duo, believe it or not.
Yeah, it's time.
It's time.
That means it's heavy and battery life is terrible too.
It's still, my battery life's great because it's an Asus, and I'm still getting like 5 to 6 hours of battery life on that thing.
Right.
But it's slow. It's getting slow.
A lot of these machines, you can get 11, 12 hours depending on the machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
Sigh.
I know. Could you cue the Charlie Brown sad music?
Do you have a deadline, Mary Jo? I mean, is this like going to have to happen at some point?
It has to happen pretty soon, relatively soon. I was thinking I was going to get it last year, but it didn't work out. So now.
I should have played that at the beginning of the earnings conference call. The PC market is eroding faster than we thought.
I'm going to get one soon.
Be fun to talk about it when you get it and why you chose it and all of that. Somebody in the chat room says no CEO talk. We haven't mentioned.
No, I guess we don't really
nothing
have
to
anything
to say, right?
The only thing to say is a report that just came out this afternoon from Bloomberg TV that said, who was it who was rumored? The latest rumor one, Vesterberg, was that it? Ericsson's Vesterberg?
Oh, Esther, the Ericsson CEO, yeah.
He, Sven according Vesterberg. To one unnamed person, he has said he's not interested in the Microsoft job. Well, I don't know if how to rank that in terms of right. denial or non-denial. He hasn't said it publicly still.
Somebody said Dvorak's going to be right. And there were some rumors that John Thompson, the man in charge of the CEO search, would finally do a pull a Dick Cheney and say, you know, I've looked everywhere.
I've looked, and it turns out I'm the best choice.
I know.
He wouldn't be a bad choice, right?
No, I think he'd be a great choice.
I think he'd be a good choice.
He's very qualified.
Yeah. Yep.
It might be the only guy who has, you know, enough knowledge to do it.
Yep.
I think Kara Swisher was the one who asked him early on in the search if he would consider it, and he said no.
No.
But
that's what Dick Cheney said early on in the search.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Although arguably being a CEO of Microsoft is a little more complex than being vice president of the United States.
Oh, a lot more. A lot more. A lot less fishing involved.
Different kind of fishing.
Or hunting. Right. Put down that shotgun, Mr. Cheney. SkyDrive and well, let's talk about Office in general. We've got some. By the way, we've got a name. Mm-hmm. OneDrive.
Yeah. That will never come under any legal scrutiny.
They own one. Actually, you know what? It's a good name.
I like it a lot.
It's a better name than SkyDrive.
I agree. So that's the best part about it.
The background, like everybody knows this probably, but the background is that Rupert Murdoch's Sky TV sued. Said, we own the Sky. And Microsoft said, oh, okay. Don't hit me. And
it turns out Microsoft owns half of the binary number system.
One is not the loneliest number nowadays. Well, Xbox One was a good name, and I think OneDrive is actually a great name.
I do, too. Windows One, by the way, not a good name.
No.
I hope they don't go nuts and do the .NET.
No.
That wouldn't be good.
It's like Microsoft starting over again. Windows One. You can write the jokes like that will occur if they rebrand anything else as One.
And the business SkyDrive Pro will be renamed SkyDrive for OneDrive for Business.
Right.
Which is fine.
Not OneDrive Pro.
Pro is not a good name, frankly.
No. Because it doesn't reflect what's really happening.
Not meaningful. It sounds like you work teaching golf for a living. It doesn't.
I also think it gives them the ability. Well, they do this now. If you think about, I think if you're in Office 365 and you look up at the menu, it's the business version. It would say SkyDrive and not SkyDrive Pro. Like they were using SkyDrive as sort of the brand.
Right.
Like think SkyDrive, think storage. You know.
Right.
So I bet they will just transition that nicely.
OneDrive.
It won't say OneDrive for Business. You know, it will just say OneDrive.
OneDrive.
You know, it's a good brand.
OneDrive. Also, Paul's got some updates to Outlook, and in particular, the web app UI.
Yeah, and actually, that's part of what you're looking at now in that OneDrive app, right? Like that UI change is starting to kind of come out.
Yeah, this is OneNote.
It still says OneNote web app, but the rumor is that this is changing to
OneNote Online.
Yeah.
So SkyDrive hasn't changed its look. But it was updated fairly recently. And OneNote Online now looks a little different. The OneNote web app. I like it.
Yeah.
I really hope they do this online branding part of this too, and they change the things that are currently called Office web apps to Office Online. I think that would be another great branding move.
Yeah.
And the other thing, if they do this, supposedly one of the ways they're going to change things is right now, if you're trying to tell somebody who doesn't really know how this works, if they want to say use what web app, blah, word web app. I know, so hard to say. Word web app. Like if I'm trying to tell my mom how to compose something in Word web app, I'm like, okay, first you have to go to SkyDrive.
Like blah, blah, blah.
Right. Then you have to hit the create tab and then you have to do this. It's not easy. And supposedly if they do this rebranding, like we're hearing of the web apps to online, you're going to go to office.com and there's going to be a place that says you want to use Word on the web, click here. You want to use Excel on the web, click here. How awesome would that be?
Sensible.
That'd be great.
Sensible.
I know.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first time I saw that, I thought, this is kind of a fine line between web apps and online, but actually, yeah, I think you're right. I think this is a much simpler and better branding.
just easier, so much easier to find it and use it. And you always know where to go.
One thing, though, they appear to be screwing up, and this is a problem today, too, is Outlook.com. Like, this whole brand is a terrible name in some ways, because Outlook is the name of a an application that's part of Office, the desktop version of Office. Outlook Web App, which used to be Outlook Web Access, is a web-based email front-end to Exchange. And so you see it in Office 365 for business. But then they have this thing called Outlook.com, which is what used to be Hotmail. It's based on completely different technology. And it looks like in the new branding, they're going to just start calling it Outlook. It's like, guys, seriously. Like, I hope that they need to figure out some way to differentiate Outlook.com from Outlook Web App, or whatever they call that, from Outlook, the application that's part of Microsoft Office. Like, they have too many things called that. Yep. They've called Outlook. So it's like a good brand. I get it. But they're kind of abusing it.
Overloading it, perhaps.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Making it do too much work. But the Office Online, that's real. They are going to call it that. Or no.
Maybe. I have screenshots of it. One of my sources, but they haven't announced that they're going to do that.
And I didn't know this, but it was 1 year ago today.
Yeah.
Sergeant Beppard taught the band to play. No, it was that that Office 365 came out. I bought it immediately.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And this is a little delayed. I've been meaning to do a post about all the stuff they've added to Office 365 in the past year, but The new business versions of it came out in February. I mean, Office 365, the business service, has, I think, been around since mid, I want to say 2011. And, of course, before that, they had something called Business Productivity Online Services. I can't believe they got rid of that brand. But this thing has kind of existed as a set of online services for a while. But the thing we sort of think of as Office 365 today, you know, came out last year. I think, you know, the big bit. And I think the two big parts of this are the home premium version, which shipped on this day a year ago. And then the small business offering. Well, there's two of them, but the small business premium, it's called small business premium. Yeah. Essentially the small business version of Office 365 home premium, where you get the 5 licenses per user. So I think that's the biggest thing. It's not so much the online service aspect of it as it is the licensing nicety of it, you know. Something that used to be really expensive and unattainable is now kind of a no-brainer from a cost perspective.
Exactly.
It's crazy how far that came, you know, in one release.
It's also interesting because, you know, Adobe kind of did the same thing with Photoshop and the Creative Cloud, and they made it a monthly subscription. You kind of had to do it, which is...
Yeah, but they didn't make it $99.
There's the difference, know? Yeah. There's
5 installs, I mean, across multiple people in a family or whatever.
Because the resistance to Creative Cloud compared to the acceptance of, I'm going to call it Office Online, might as well get used to it, is dramatic. People seem to like Office. Well, what did you just say? 25% adoption rate in business? It's doing
60% of the Fortune 500.
It's doing very well.
Yeah, 3.5 million consumers.
Yeah. And we're going to call it Office. Is there a time frame for Office Online? Did the name change?
I bet it's pretty quick.
Soon. Do it all at once. Do OneDrive, everything all at once.
I think it'll be around that time.
I don't have any. I bet this happens quick because there's going to be that new navigation bar. Mm-hmm. I bet this happens pretty quick. Yeah. Maybe in tandem with the OneDrive switcher.
Yeah. Maybe in tandem with Windows 8.1 Update 1.
Yeah. There you go. Maybe. Which actually probably should have that OneDrive branding in it when you think about it.
Maybe Cortana could introduce could tell it. By the way, those Cortana videos you've all seen, Paul says they're fake.
Likely fake. Although, actually, you know, I have a note in here that, you know, Windows Phone 8.1 has not really leaked in any appreciable way, right? We've seen a picture of a notification center. We know a couple of basic things about it. But I talked to someone. I've been trying to find anything I could about Windows Phone 8.1. There really isn't a lot out there. And someone just told me from Microsoft that, you know, this thing looks fake and people are calling it fake. And the guy said he faked it or whatever. But it appears to be based on what it's supposed to look like. Like, the way he described it to me was actually, I'm not saying it's real, but don't automatically assume that's not kind of what it's going to be. I mean, that's one thing I've heard directly.
That's interesting,
yeah.
The tweet that announced it is gone. He deleted it.
sure. So, that's this is from that WP leaks or whatever it was
something
called.
Something like that, yeah. So there you go. Yeah. When you delete the tweet, that's a
it's a sign.
Delete the tweet.
Deleted the tweet.
I'm surprised Twitter allows that.
Well, yeah, you can delete a tweet, but tweets never go away. That's something I've learned.
Jeez. It's like tick.
Yeah. Microsoft is joining the ARM server effort.
Yeah, this was very intriguing. This is news from today at the Open Compute Project Summit out in San Jose. There's a whole group of people who are backing ARM server development and the other backers are Red Hat, SUSE, Canonical, HP, Dell, and then you get Microsoft thrown in there. And Microsoft's never said they are porting Windows Server to ARM. So that's throwing a few people for a loop and saying, does this mean now we're going to have Windows Server running on ARM? Microsoft hasn't really said at all why they're participating other than, you know, they're interested in what happens in the server world. And they just want to make sure, given they are partners with some of these companies who are in the coalition, that they're on board with where they're going.
So one of the issues, according to the keynote, is that there are multiple OSs on these multiple different systems on a chip's versions of ARM. So it's kind of a lot of overlap right now.
Yeah. Yep.
But I don't think they're going to settle on Microsoft. They're probably settling on Linux, right? I would guess.
You would think. Maybe that's why they're in there, just to make sure they're not left out.
Just to have a vote in the
thing. Yeah. And speaking of open compute, the other big news this week, Facebook has been the big backer of this thing called the Open Compute Project, which is supposed to help people who want to design servers that are kind of like no-brand servers that are cheaper and better suited for running data centers. Microsoft joined that project this week, and they actually open-sourced some of their own data center designs. And the reason that's interesting to users is if you're somebody who's building your own data center in-house as an IT administrator, you're now going to have access to these designs if you want them. So you can see how Microsoft builds its own servers in its gigantic data centers and see if there's any lessons, any kind of specifications or reference designs that might be useful to you in terms of bringing down the cost in your own data centers.
I really love this trend. Facebook did it, Google did it, now Microsoft's doing it. And these, of course, are companies that really have to scale. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So it's. I think it's fascinating, and it's great that they're doing that.
Yep.
It's not secret sauce anymore, probably, but.
It kind of is, though, in a way, if you think about it. Like how much money did Microsoft spend to come up with these designs? I mean, it took them years to perfect this. And now they run these mega data centers, but. I think a lot of the reason they're probably backing this whole play is that it's Facebook and they're trying to be very tightly aligned with Facebook.
Right. Facebook says the Open Compute Project helped save it $1.2 billion in infrastructure over the last 3 years. That's according to Run With Scissors in our chat room. This is important stuff. And, you know, it's meaningful for all of us because we're all using those servers. We're the users.
Right.
So keeping the costs down, the power use down is really important. Mm-hmm. I'm glad. Thank you, Microsoft, for participating there, I think.
By the way, there is one important news story we didn't cover, which is the headline, Kansas man runs into burning home to save Xbox.
What? Was it a 360 or a 1?
I don't know, but a bunch of people have sent me this on Twitter over the past couple
days. See, the mainstream news never really tells you the things you want to know.
Well, I had the follow-up, which was, if it was a PS4, he would have let it burn.
Oh, Paul. Paul. Such a partisan.
Oh. Saves well, when it comes to Xbox, Leo, what can I say?
Would I run in to save? No, you know what? I'll be honest. I would probably run in to save my Mac Pro.
I would save, like, the basically like a home server that I have that has like
your data. Yeah, your data. Yeah.
Probably go for that.
Those are my saved games, man. I don't want to
One time I had, in one of my last apartments, I had a radiator explode in my apartment. And the first thing I did was grab my laptop and I ran out of the building with it. And I was standing outside and I'm like, wait, what about everything else in my apartment? Wow.
I forgot my shoes.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
Yeah, I think that it's
I'm
funny.
I'm naked, but I've got my laptop.
Right. Exactly. Like that natural reaction is so very telling, you know, because you can sort of sit here and talk about what's important to you. But I think that shows.
No, I'd grab my laptop. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm well backed up.
Yeah, I feel like I'm pretty good backed up. That's why, you know, grabbing the home server in many ways would just be a convenience, because the truth is all this stuff is backed up. You know, so it would be a stupid and risky thing to try to pull that up.
Yeah. Let's take a break. When we come back, we got beer, we got Enterprise, we got all sorts of stuff. Because, you know, it's Windows Weekly, friends. And that's what we live for. Bing apps, things like that. Our show today brought to you by the good folks at Squarespace.com. If it's time for you to upgrade your website, maybe make it look a little better, run a little faster. Maybe it's time to get your first website up. Or maybe you're a photographer, an artist, you want to have a portfolio online. Squarespace is the place to get your next website, constantly improving the platform. And because with Squarespace, you're getting hosting, yes, but also their great content management system on top of that. It's always up to date. It's always secure. It is a great place to create your next website. Get started for 2 weeks free. You don't need to give them a credit card, any personal information. Just click the Get Started button. You can set up a site, and have the full run of the place. Start with those 20 beautiful designer templates, every one of them mobile responsive. That means you don't have a separate mobile site. All the sites look great no matter what size the screen, from a 27-inch monitor to a little iPhone 5S. They always look good. Take a look when you choose a template. That's what some people, these are real sites that some people have designed based on that template. Each of them unique, reflecting the style, the feeling that each individual user wants to create. They tend to be very visual, and I think that makes sense. The web is visual, and Squarespace really knows how to do that. When you upload an image, for instance, they make 9 separate thumbnails so that it'll look good on any size screen. They've got some great apps, too. If you have not yet seen their mobile apps, they always had a wonderful blogging app. It's called Blog, that lets you post to your Squarespace site, moderate comments, and more. But they also have their new Metrics app, which lets you keep track of your site, unique visitors, page views, social media follows, things like that. Really is a nice, nice app. If you go to Squarespace.com, tour around, take a look, visit all the different features, take a look at the support team, by the way. Really great support. The Stevie Award-winning support, 24/7 from the actual people at the Squarespace headquarters in New York. You'll see why this is so great. After you've tried it for 2 weeks, you may want to buy it. Can I tell you? $8 a month. $8 a month for an annual plan. With the annual plan, you not only get a great price, you also get a custom domain name free, and they'll hook it up for you. The professional plan, which a lot of people use, is really great because you have unlimited everything. Unlimited bandwidth, unlimited contributors, unlimited pages, unlimited galleries, unlimited blogs. Oh, this is new. You can now sell up to 20 products if you want to try the e-commerce on the professional platform. So it's got a kind of a simple way to try e-commerce from Squarespace. If you decide you want to go with a full e-commerce platform, that's only $24 a month. And that means unlimited products, digital or physical or services, fully integrated, real-time carrier shipping, label printing via ShipStation, integrated accounting. They got it all. And if you are, you don't need to be a developer. You don't need to know any JavaScript or CSS, but if you do, the developer platform is fabulous. It gives you a beautiful access to CSS, HTML, JavaScript. You can use Git. They've got an editor that uses color coding for syntax. It's just really nice. And with every annual plan, you get a custom domain name free. So try it out. The only thing I'd ask, you don't need our offer code to get started. Just try it for free for 2 weeks. But if you decide to buy, use our offer code Windows1 and you'll get 10% off your new account. And that's pretty nice.
Squarespace.com, the best place for your next website. Even their code is beautiful, just elegant stuff. We're big fans. And a lot of the people we work with, including us, have Squarespace blogs. Our Inside Twit blog is running on Squarespace.
Yep.
Yep. You wish yours were, I can tell.
No, my book blogs are.
The book blogs are. Ah.
Yep.
There you go. Which are Windows 8.
Phone book.
Windows phonebook.com and Windows81book.com.
Right.
Let's get a little tip of the week from Mr. Paul Thurrott.
Yeah, actually, speaking of Windows81book.com, in writing the book, you know, if you think about it, you space out whatever the chapters are going to be and you kind of write them over time. And one of the ones I'd been putting off was one that was going to deal with the Bing apps that are a part of Windows 8.1. The theory being that this is kind of a boring topic and there's nothing really going on there. And actually, in investigating these apps more deeply than I had in the past, what I've discovered is these apps are really kind of incredible. And I'll probably be writing a post to the super site to kind of detail some of this stuff, but just as kind of a high-level overview. Microsoft shipped, I want to say, four or so Bing apps in Windows 8, the original version. You know, news, finance, sports, weather, and then actually maps. And, of course, it was actually also just a Bing app, which has now disappeared from Windows. In Windows 8.1, they added food and drink and health and fitness. And those sound like kind of superfluous topics that, you know, like they've run out of things to do and they're just making more apps or whatever. But these apps are actually far more incredible than I think people realize. And most of them share kind of a common navigation scheme, beautiful layouts and all that kind of stuff. And that's neat. Most of them have some sense of favorites, you know, like a web browser. So you can have favorite places and maps. You can have favorite recipes and, you know, food and drink perhaps, or, you know, favorite sports, favorite teams, and Bing Sports and all that kind of stuff. And so there's a lot of commonality between them, which I think is cool. They all integrate with the smart search feature in Windows 8.1, which is really neat, meaning that when you search for something, you can often click on a link and it actually loads something in the app rather than just like a web page somewhere. So you get that kind of really rich experience. And that's cool. But I think the coolest thing about these apps, and the thing that most people probably don't understand, is the deep, deep integration that they have with online services. And I'll just provide two examples. One is that Microsoft has this thing called Health Vault, which is like an online service for centralizing your health data. And that can be things like, you know, you're tracking your weight, your blood pressure, your, you know, maybe you have diabetes or some other problem, or you're doing exercise tracking or whatever it might be. And you can go through this kind of central clearinghouse if you want to. I just lost video, by the way.
Yeah, we turned it off because
it's so bad. Okay.
Conserving bandwidth.
So, yeah. No, that's fine. So why would you want to use something like Microsoft Health Vault? Well, you can use different mobile apps or web apps or whatever to do different forms of tracking today. If you get like a Nike Fuel Band like I have, you use the Nike stuff and it uploads to some Nike service somewhere and you can, that's pretty much locked into that. But if you're doing like weight tracking in a different app and you're checking your weight every single day, you can do that over there. But those two things never kind of connect up. And one of the neat things about Health Vault is that if you give it permission to, it can provide information in two different directions. So for example, you could use Bing Health and Fitness to track your weight, your diet, you know, whatever, all the food that you eat. But maybe use like a Fitbit device, which is one of those devices that is compatible with Health Vault. Even though Fitbit doesn't connect to Bing Health and Fitness, Bing, it does connect on the back end to Health Vault. And so that data from your exercise actually does get pushed forward to Bing Health and Fitness through Health Vault. And it's just kind of a neat back and forth. Likewise, your profile information, if you set it up in Health Vault, gets pushed down to the app, of course. But this information can go back and forth between compatible services and devices. And so there are obviously many medical devices, and there are many that are compatible with the service. So that to me is kind of incredible. Bing Fitness is another example. I'm sorry, Bing Finance is another example where it integrates with various like brokerage type accounts, E-Trade, Fidelity, you know, whatever the other ones are. There are a bunch of them. And you know, again, you get this kind of integration thing where you sign into your account through the app. You can have a tile on your desktop, or your start screen in Windows 8.1 that follows your savings portfolio or whatever it is, your retirement portfolio. next to one for your favorite sports team, next to one for the news topic that you're tracking, next to the one for whatever. You know, all of these Bing apps have all of these kind of capabilities. And I just think that whole combined quality that they have with the integration with each other, with all these online services, many of which don't come from Microsoft, and then the capabilities that they all have, you know, pinning favorites, beautiful layouts and everything. It's like this incredible, rich resource of stuff. And I don't think anyone even looks at this stuff. Like, I didn't really, I used the news app. I mean, but I really hadn't used these apps too much. And in really going through them for the book, I'm kind of blown away by, again, because, you know, in Windows 8, the original 4 or 5, I was really impressed by. But even the new ones, which I thought were just kind of silly, are actually fairly incredible apps. Plus, I learned how to make a cocktail out of beer.
I like the cocktail app. That's a good app. Well, you can find all about it. It's a new chapter at the Windows81book.com.
Yeah, Windows81book.com. It's hard not to go on and on about it because there's so much to it. But the chapter is like 47 pages long, so you get an idea. It's a lot of stuff there.
By the way, just the news coming in from a Neowin that, surprise, surprise, turns out there is a cloud-based storage app company that's been around for a couple of years called One.com.
Yep.
And the owner says, yeah, we're looking into a lawsuit here.
Yep.
Damn.
The only thing I can say
I'm surprised Microsoft didn't do more research before they
picked you're assuming sure they did.
Obviously
they did. Of course
they did.
And there's also something called Ubuntu One, which a lot of people have been freaking out over.
Right. Yeah, but this is directly Ubuntu One is storage. Actually, you're right.
Sure.
It's a cloud.
Well, so is One.com, apparently.
Right. They both are. Yeah.
Yep.
Whoops. Mm.
I don't think it's possible that they didn't know about this stuff.
You would have thought Metro and Sky, they would have looked into those two.
But after SkyDrive, now you're renaming SkyDrive. Are you really going to do the same thing again? You're going to not look? I mean, I think that's part of the process, right? I mean, I don't think this is going
to
be.
It's hard to find a name that isn't taken. I will be honest with you.
Yes.
That's why, I mean, I've gone through this, way back in 1994, or 95, we were looking for a name for the new show on MSNBC. And even by then, you had to register not just the name of the show, but the domain name, the email, and all of that stuff. And they ended up calling it The Site.
I remember, thesite.com.
Thesite.com, because it was so generic, they could still get it. And here we are. Almost 20 years later, it's even worse. All the good names are taken.com. That actually is a website.
All the good names are taken.com.
Yeah.
Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
That would be a great donate.
Somebody has it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, he's not doing anything with it. It says nothing to see here yet. It said that for like 8 years. But he's got the name. Someday, Microsoft might be looking. Software pick of the week.
So this one will be quicker than the last one. This week, I guess Rockstar released Grand Theft Auto San Andreas for Windows Phone. And this is interesting because the mobile version of this game debuted, I think, in December on iOS and then again on Android. And this is actually a pretty quick turnaround time for us to get a game like this. This game dates the PC or console version of it dates back 10 years. It's actually from 2004, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
But I guess it's been updated with new graphics, and obviously it's been, you know, fine-tuned to work on touch-based devices. It's not my kind of game, and I don't mean that from like a violence, whatever standpoint. It's like an open-world game. It's, you know, it was kind of one of the early versions of this kind of, you know, first-person open-world type game.
This is not top-down, though. This is the first-person.
No, it's first-person. Yeah. So, interesting. I think a lot of people will want to get this. It's expensive for a mobile game. I think it's like $6.99, but I have a feeling a lot of people will be very excited to at least give it a shot, so I wanted to at least mention it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And Mary Jo Foley has the Enterprise pick of the week.
Yep, the Enterprise pick is Windows Intune this week. Windows Intune is Microsoft's device management and security service. It's a cloud service for managing not just Windows-based devices, but also iOS and Android these days. And what was really interesting is this week, Microsoft opened up publicly about what's coming in the next versions of Intune. And the reason it's I seem surprised about that is last year we couldn't get them to say almost anything about Windows Intune. Even when they announced the version that was codenamed Windows Intune E, when they actually were shipping it and making it available, we still couldn't get them to tell us what was in it feature-wise on the week they were announcing it. Now, instead, this year, they seem to be taking a different approach. And they're telling us that next week they're going to have a rollout with a bunch of new features for Intune, specifically some changes around how administrators can configure email profiles, some of the new support that they're adding for iOS 7, mobile device management, and remote lock and remote password reset for devices, all being added to Intune next week for current subscribers. But they even went one better this week with that. They actually told us about features they're going to have in Windows Intune before the end of 2014. Now, this probably isn't the whole list of everything they're going to add, but they did get fairly specific in a blog post they put out this week. They talked about some of the new Exchange email inbox management that they're going to be adding, a much, much deeper level of email management, some new application restrictions that they're going to add, whitelisting and blacklisting app supports being added, URL filtering for web browser management. There's a whole bunch of different things. So you can go to Microsoft's own In the Cloud blog and you can see the full list of features. I just thought it was really interesting that this year, instead of doing what they did last year, keeping us in the dark, they're actually being proactive and telling us what's coming with Windows Intune.
Hmm. Very nice. And our code name comes from, I think, Australia. No?
I actually should ask you guys where this code name came from.
Well, I'm thinking code name is... Go ahead.
It's Booty Bay.
Booty Bay.
Booty Bay. It's a code name, I think, from World of Warcraft. I'm like the last person who should know this. But
I think you might be right.
Yeah. So here's how it came about, which is very interesting. There's been a lot of controversy in Microsoft land about sideloading of Windows 8 apps. Microsoft's allowed it, but it's required quite a bit of money. You have to basically have been a fairly large ISV or developer with deep pockets and somebody who's willing to navigate some very complex licensing to do Windows 8 app sideloading by publishing through the Windows Store, but not having everybody in the world see your app. You know, if it's an app you want to just kind of publish out to your own employees, this is what sideloading is. So there have been a lot of complaints by developers about how complex and expensive this is, and Microsoft really hasn't said if they had any kind of a resolution to this in the works. So a group of Microsoft employees in China who call themselves Lighthouse, and they have a Lighthouse blog, they created this app that they're calling Booty Bay to get around how onerous Microsoft's own restrictions are for sideloading. And they uploaded the app to CodePlex, an alpha of it. So I wrote about it yesterday, and they've already pulled it down off of CodePlex and destroyed their blog post.
Oh.
Sadly.
Yeah. You so did. They would have been completely under the radar.
Yeah, I know. I feel bad because at least they were trying to solve these issues. Although the good side of this whole Booty Bay thing is it brought to light this whole controversy again. And there are some hints that Microsoft might talk about sideloading at Build. And there may be something new to say. So maybe these guys jumped the gun a little. I don't know. But they did have a pretty fun code name. And they actually had some code, which has disappeared.
Yeah.
So that's why we've got Booty
Not
Bay.
Surprising.
And you would know if you played World of Warcraft, Booty Bay is a large pirate city nestled in the cliffs.
I'm sorry, Mr. LaPorte, but your description is incorrect.
I believe you get there via Stranglethorn Vale. You could take a ship from Ratchet if you're so inclined.
Yeah, well, as soon as I published it, I put World of Warcraft 3 was the inspiration, and immediately people who played said to me, "What's World of Warcraft 3? You don't even know what you're talking about." I'm like, "You're right, I don't."
Except you're right. Yeah, but you're right. It was a map in Warcraft 3, Reign of Chaos. So
I guess Warcraft 3, World of Warcraft 3.
Not World of Warcraft. There's the difference. Yeah. That was prior to World of Warcraft. Although it might be in World of Warcraft. I don't know.
Yeah.
Here's a shocker. Just crossed the wire from TechCrunch. Lenovo is buying Motorola from Google.
Wait, what?
Wait, what?
Are you serious?
I'm just quoting TechCrunch. TechCrunch has confirmed reports that state Lenovo is buying Motorola Mobility from Google. This is the division within Google the company purchased in 2011 for $12.5 billion. The terms of the deal not revealed, but we're hearing the price was near $3 billion, a loss of nine.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a lot less than they paid for it.
Billion dollars.
Oh, this isn't anywhere. This is only on TechCrunch.
Wow, that's a kind of a shocker.
Where did you see this?
TechCrunch.
Nicely played.
Whoa. Yeah, and I just bought a new Moto X, and now I'm wondering maybe that wasn't the right thing to do. Holy moly.
I don't know. Honestly, Lenovo is a great company. I this may not be terrible.
They don't make phones, do they? Or do they in China?
Yeah, they
maybe
do.
They do.
And weren't,
yeah, they were planning to expand to the U.S. this year.
Right. Weren't they going to make a Windows phone? Wasn't that a rumor?
Not anymore.
Yeah, it was a rumor, but I expect them to stick with...
They're currently Android phones, so it would make sense.
I don't even see this on TechCrunch, though.
News of the potential acquisition comes from Reuters and China Daily. Hmm.
I wonder if it's true. These are the Lenovo phones available only in somewhere, not here. They are all Android phones. Wow. Hmm. For young doers, it says.
Okay.
Hmm. I just have this report, Matt Burns, TechCrunch.
Okay, Reuters has a story.
Reuters as well.
Yeah. And China Daily has a story, too.
Actually, Reuters has a tweet, which they describe as a Reuters exclusive.
But TechCrunch says they've now confirmed. I don't know. Interesting. I don't know what confirmed means.
Yeah.
That is a shocker. And I'm
Daily says the deal could be announced Thursday morning in Beijing.
It's a little disappointing to me, frankly. Mm-hmm. But we'll talk more about that this week in Google is coming up next. $3 billion would be a massive loss. Although, I'm wondering, maybe Google keeps the patents, which is probably the real reason they bought Lenovo.
That would be hilarious.
Yeah.
And thus giving the lie to all that baloney.
Right.
But I bet that's true.
Yeah.
This is still not as big of a story as the guy running in his house to get the Xbox, but I understand why he brought it up.
It doesn't say all patents. It says, Reuters says, Lenovo's in the final stages of talks to buy the Google division that includes smartphones, Moto X and Moto G, as well as certain patents. I bet you that's why it's considerably less money.
Yeah.
There were rumors.
Are you suggesting that most of the value of Motorola Mobility was those mobile patents?
Well, apparently the Moto X isn't selling all that well, which surprises me because it's my phone of choice and I really like it.
Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah. I just got ordered another one with bamboo. So
yeah,
that'll go over well with our new Chinese overlords.
Instead of putting the stenciling in the back to like burn something in, with
I don't know. I ordered Chief Twit on the back. We'll see how they do that. They should burn it in with one of those little word burning.
Exactly,
kits.
That's what I mean. That would be excellent.
That'd be so awesome. You know what? If they don't, I will. Beer pick of the week.
Yes, the beer pick of the week. I was trying to find something that went with Booty Bay as a beer pick. So I ended up with Ballast Point Victory at Sea. So it kind of sounds like a pirate beer, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's got a skull and crossbones on the cover.
It does.
On the label.
Right, so this is a great beer for the weather we've been having here on the East Coast. It's a very big, rich, vanilla imperial porter, 10.0% ABV. But man, I've had this a few times, and it is so smooth and delicious. It tastes like dessert in a bottle.
It's smooth and good.
Yeah, it's so good. We've had it on tap here in New York, but also it's findable in bottles. And I would very thoroughly recommend it if you like big vanilla porters. Paul might like this one.
It's got vanilla in it?
Porters, yeah.
It tastes like vanilla. I don't know if they actually brewed it with vanilla. I don't recall.
Dessert.
But it's good. really good.
Have you gotten a chance to try that Spencer Trappist Ale?
I did. I shared your opinion of that.
Okay, so a little too spicy.
A little too clovey. Yeah, that was the first. Paul and I both got to try the first Abbey.
First American Trappist, right?
First American Trappist.
It's the first non-European.
That's right.
Trappist Ale.
Trappist Ale. I think it's going to be good as it ages a little, probably.
Yeah, it needs to calm down. It's
it does.
It's
spicy, but still pretty cool that we're brewing Trappist Ales in America now. Mm-hmm.
It's really expensive.
Yeah, it's from Massachusetts, right?
Yeah. I didn't get the hometown discount for some reason. Yeah, it is from somewhere in Massachusetts.
Yeah. I think Spencer, right?
It's from Spencer, Massachusetts, right?
It's called Spencer, right?
I wonder where. Where Spencer. Where in Massachusetts might it be from?
Yeah.
Yes, Spencer.
I did. Yeah, I'm glad I got to try it.
Did you get it on tap? Is that available on tap?
No, a friend of mine brought it back from Massachusetts, and I got to taste it.
Okay, yeah. I have more of it. I'll keep trying it.
I have more of it.
Yeah. Just as a, I bought a purely as a research project.
I'm going to keep tasting it until I like it.
Until I like it. Yeah, it turns it, 2-3 bottles usually does it.
Yeah, that's right. It's not the first beer of the night. It's the last. Paul Thurrott is at the Supersite for Windows, winsupersite.com. Don't forget his two books, free online, or you can pay a couple of bucks and support Paul's efforts at windows81book.com and windowsphonebook.com. Really a great place to go to read up on either one of those fine platforms. Mary Jo Foley is at allaboutmicrosoft.com, and they both join us each and every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1900 UTC to talk Windows and Microsoft. Always enjoy this show. I apologize for the Skype issues. We're working on that. In fact, we were going to try Link with Mary Jo, and we're going to see if we can get Microsoft's Link working, because we have a Link server.
So something changed, though, right? I mean, the last hour was fine.
We changed over to her cable connection.
Oh. Yeah, I switched to cable.
And that was the one that was giving us fits earlier, and now it's fine, and the DSL's bad. So, Internet. Okay. You can't live with it. You can't live without it.
Yeah.
We will see y'all next time, next week, on Windows Weekly.